So, Mark, I think you can go ahead and get started.
Perfect. Thank you, Clint. Welcome, everyone. It's delightful to be here. This is the first call in our course and our journey, our exploration, Living Beyond Complexity, which originally began as Second Simplicity. And let me begin with just saying hello, you know, a brief introduction of myself and my colleagues, and then really enter into this, you know, very, very exciting, very profound, we hope, and really leading edge exploration of what the next steps might be in our great understanding of all that is. Because that's really what this is going to be about. It's going to be about an attempt to get the best vision we can of the patterns that connect. And all of us, right, Rebecca West wrote once that there's a desperate yearning, right, to feel the pattern, right, to feel the patterns that connect, right, to get a sense of the whole. And that's the context that we're going to be looking at, and that's the vision that we're going to be moving towards, because, of course, as I'll unpack a little bit later, right, the sense of the whole affects everything. What my vision of the whole is affects how I act in every part of my life. So that's just kind of a word to begin. Second introduction, I think I know a lot of you or most of you from previous courses or live encounters. I'm sure there's people that I don't know, and I look forward to meeting you. My name is Mark Goffney, and I'm the father of Zion, who's my new son, who's about 6 months old, and partnered with Mariana, and the father of three other children, grown children. And I'm also privileged to be the director of Integral Spiritual Experience and the founder and director of the Center for World Spirituality and a scholar in residence of the Integral Institute, you know, which are kind of just the kind of lower right roles, if you will, which I'm delighted to play. And in my life, because I couldn't really get another job, I function as a spiritual teacher, which is actually a great honor and privilege, perhaps more of a spiritual artist, right, trying to kind of paint the canvas, and a reluctant meta-theorist, right, meta-theory being, right, the attempt to kind of get a sense of what the broad picture is, how to connect the dots, right, but from the perspective of a spiritual teacher or a spiritual human being or a human being having a spiritual experience, right, and as I'm looking for the broad pattern, because that affects the fullness, the depth, the eros, and the ethos, right, the goodness, the truth, and the beauty of how I live my life, of how I try and teach my son how to live his life, and how I interact and how we all engage this world. I have three delightful colleagues on the phone. Nicole Fegley, ladies first, is still true, even in a post-patriarchal world. And Nicole is the curator of the Integral Spiritual Experience and a partner in Core Integral. And Nicole, is with us on the call and will be, of course, leading in the second week one of the breakout calls. Together with her is Clint Fuse. And Clint is a young integral philosopher. He's the founder with Nicole of Core Integral, which is doing this awesome job of really formulating integral theory in the best way possible and disseminating it. And, of course, whenever you formulate, you engage also in its evolution, which is part of the process of formulation, right? And Clint is a young colleague and friend, and delightful to be with you, Clint, and Zach Stein. And Zach also is a young colleague and friend. Zach works out on the East Coast. We're going to try and get him to the West Coast as soon as we can. And he is a young philosopher, right, engaged both in kind of the social action of trying to create better metrics in the world, right, and unpacking, right, you know, meta-theory, right, visions of thought within integral and non-integral frameworks, right, as is Clint. And Zach and Clint will be on both the first, second, and third calls. They'll be leading breakout calls in week two, and will be on the first and third calls, and they'll be functioning sometimes as kind of witnesses and sometimes in a kind of meta-theory, Bill Moyers kind of role, and kind of bringing commentary after the core Dharma presentation, right, bringing kind of commentary, kind of weaving, right, the kind of general vision we're going to try and unfold within the particular context of integral theory and beyond. Now, I just want to say before we get going, or perhaps we've already gotten going, but just in the beginning, just as the way of setting context, my lineage master, Abraham Cook, said that all of this generation is about setting the right context. So in terms of setting context, we're doing something here very, very unusual, very exciting. And for us, it's a beginning. It's a first step. We're calibrating as we go. This has never been done before. Right? Instead of doing a straight theory course, right, or a kind of spiritual teaching transmission course, you know, emerging from the great traditions and the best emergent, right, post-great traditions understandings of spirit, we've kind of brought together both the best of theory with Clint and Zach, right, the best of integral coaching with Nicole, right, and I'm going to try and embody somewhat of theory and somewhat of spiritual teaching and somewhat of kind of meta-theorist great picture, and we're going to try and unfold together what we might call next steps in the great picture, right, next steps in integral theory. We're going to emerge out of integral theory. Of course, Ken, right, Ken Wilber, who's our good friend, will energetically be with us on all the calls, and will actually at some point actually participate in one of our live encounters. And we're going to try and really go deep, not get lost in jargon, but be very precise, go as deep as we possibly can, open our hearts as wide as we can, and bring our hearts, minds, and bodies together as we engage in the great evolutionary act of Dharma. And Dharma is knowing. Dharma is theory. And theory, right, is not a kind of male brainiac engagement, right, when really there's nothing better to do and men just kind of get lost in their theories. Theory is actually a form of loving, right? Theory is the best picture we have of reality that enables us to live, right, the highest lives of love, of compassion, of recognition, of union, of embrace. Right? It's the best theory that includes the most, that offers a place at the table, right, for the most possible understandings and seeks their higher integration. And from that integration, right, from that vision, right, comes a world of greater depth, right, of greater goodness, of greater truth, of greater beauty. And so the engagement here, right, is not a kind of dry, arid, intellectual engagement. It's not an engagement from the neck up. I remember when I was writing my doctorate at Oxford, I would sit in the Bodleian Library, and a kind of desiccated picture of Western thought appeared there, which was five men from the neck up, sculptured at the entry to the Bodleian Library. That's not our goal. Our goal is a fully integrated enlightenment of fullness, an integrated masculine-feminine encounter as the masculine and feminine dances in us in our ways of knowing. There are not just women's ways of knowing or masculine ways of knowing. There's a whole way of knowing that integrates the masculine, the feminine, the heart, the body, the mind, the spirit. And so that's what we're looking for. And as I said, right, our encounter, our engagement, our pursuit is passionate. We're passionately concerned, right, with these ultimate issues which affect, right, the very fabric, right, of our lives, our individual lives, the very fabric of the lives of the larger collectives in which we live, and the very fabric of the cosmos, not only the cosmos with a C, right, the kind of flatland physical world, but cosmos, right, borrowing from Plotinus, right, cosmos with a K, right, cosmos, the larger system of life on all levels, right, that exists. Its future depends on our ability, right, to think into the future. Hope is a memory of the future, right, to unfold, to discern the future vision of what is, what might be, based on the highest integration, right, of all the fields, the disciplines of knowing that generally are in exile from each other, but to actually redeem them, liberate them from their exile, right, and begin to bring them together in a higher integration, in a higher mutual recognition, in a higher embrace. That's our engagement. That's our framework. That's our context, right, in this attempt to live beyond complexity and touch a second simplicity. And by second simplicity, and let's really begin here, part two. So one of the ways that I've been teaching for the last, you know, 10, 15 years, based on some writing I did about a decade ago that was published in a book called Mystery of Love, Sounds True, audio version called On Eros and Holiness, right, was what I called a theory of levels. And I'm not going to use the word levels because that'll get complicated, complex in terms of integral theory, and we're trying to live beyond complexity. So the word levels has a very particular meaning in integral theory. So I'll use the word just for the sake of it, right, a kind of spectrum of stations, right, a spectrum of unfoldings, right, a spectrum of phases, right, threes, holy trinities, always one, two, three, station one, station two, station three. And I found that these stations are unbelievably helpful in unpacking our lives and actually seeing the patterns of our lives. And of course, we'll talk either at the end of this call or in next week's call about the relationship of these stations to the classical states, the classical state stages, and the classical structure stages that are so key to integral theory. But for now, I just want to kind of point out that there are these holy trinities, these three stations. For those of you who might have been at the Integral Spiritual Experience number 2, which is so completely awesome, a few weeks back, we based it on what I called the three stations of love. So let me talk just for a few minutes about just what these three stations are, kind of in a very broad sense, and then look, right, as is, you know, set out in our curriculum, which we're going to try and follow with some degree of rigor to really be in integrity, to really give you what we promise to the best of our ability, even as we allow for the spontaneous unfolding of spirit in action in the moment. Let me try and offer kind of a broad overview for just a few minutes of what this set of holy trinities, if you will, is. And let me begin with simplicity, complexity, second simplicity. Simplicity. Simplicity is the simple-minded one, the simple-minded one who, for whom everything is clear. Everything is obvious. There are no questions. Extremists, right, are often simple. Simple doesn't mean not smart. You can have a very high IQ, right, be very smart, to put that word in indented quotation marks, but be simple. So an extremist is simple because for an extremist, there's a very simple view of the world. An extremist chooses one value and says that value trumps all values, and that value organizes all of reality. And of course, extremists feel better when they wake up in the morning, right? Because life is simple. It's clear. When life is simple and clear, right, it seems sometimes easier. There was a great scene, and I think it was a Robert Redford movie called 3 Days of the Condor. And the head of the CIA was the villain in the movie and had woven this enormously web of treachery and treason. And when Redford kind of uncovers the web at the very end and accosts, you know, this corrupt head of the CIA, right, somehow they engage in a conversation in which the head of the CIA says, you know, I miss the war days. And by the war days, he means World War II. And Redford, the Redford character, says, why? Because it was more exciting then? He said, no, because it was more clear. It was more simple then. Right? That's simplicity. Simplicity is you're not willing to engage the complexity, right? So everything's simple. That's level one, or if you will, station one. Let's stick with the word station. Right? So at that station, you have lots of clarity. You have simplicity, and you have the power of that simplicity. Fundamentalism, right, is a phenomena of consciousness, right, which operates often at this level of simplicity, right, at this station one of simplicity. A fundamentalist has a very clear vision of the world. His or her set of values are very clear, and there's very clear trumping values around which all else organizes. So, for example, let's say that you have a fundamentalist position, an extremist fundamentalist position, which is extremely anti-abortion. So it's a radical pro-life position. So in that vision, life is simplicity. Life is the first station of simplicity because life becomes the organizing value. Everything is organized around the value of life. And so, for example, if a young 17-year-old girl is impregnated through incest, right, by her father, and there's some nascent life, right, which exists when the young woman realizes 3 weeks later that she's pregnant. So for the extremist fundamentalist position, right? What you do in that situation is very simple, right? You have the woman bear the child, right? And if possible, raise the child. But certainly, abortion's not a possibility because life is the guiding value, right? It is the overarching value. It trumps all other values. We don't require it to hold complexity, meaning we don't require it to be in dialectical relationship, in dialectical tension with other values, right? So everything's very simple. That's the first level. That's simplicity, expressed in the fundamentalist position, right? Expressed in any position that engages life through an extremist lens. And an extremist lens means, right, you engage one value and you simply, right, let that value trump the other values and you liberate that value from the need to engage complexity. Now, lest you liberals on the phone are feeling too good, okay, with much blessing, honor, love, and respect, right, understand that this first station of simplicity exists across the political spiritual spectrum. So, for example, in the pro-life example, on the other side of the spectrum, you might have, right, an extremist pro-choice position. And in the extremist pro-choice position, right, a young woman, right, who is 26, right, who is 6 months pregnant, but it's coming towards summer, she wanted the baby, but as she saw the new, you know, line of bikinis, right, the image of herself in a bikini, you know, in the upcoming summer was so attractive, right, and the egoic, right, gratification was so strong that despite the fact that she willfully engaged, right, pregnancy, right, wanted the baby, right, the overwhelming egoic desire, right, made her choose an abortion. Now, the extremist pro-choice position says, right, the woman owns her body. Right, the woman has full proprietary rights over her body. Therefore, it's appropriate and even moral in the extremist position, right, as long as the baby's not born, right, for the woman to make that choice. Right, that choice is completely appropriate, and there's nothing we could or should do, right, to legislate against it for sure. Right, because it's very clear, we're pro-choice in an extremist sense. Choice becomes, right, the clear value, which is freed from its obligation, right, to compete, right, to engage, right, the complexity, right, of other seemingly contradictory values. And so therefore, again, the choice becomes simple. The choice is an extremist position of pro-choice, right? Everything's clear, right, and everything's good. So these are first-level simplicity positions. Now, let's go to the second level, or the second station. So the second station would be complexity. Right, and complexity means, right, when I begin to understand to engage, right, the complexity. Right, the competition between values is one example of complexity. Right, the enormous amount of factors we need, right, in order to, right, conjure up an intelligent position on any particular issue, right, is another example of complexity. As I've been talking to my friends in the last couple of weeks, right, people have very clear, knee-jerk, simple positions on whether what happens in Egypt, right, this incredible outpouring, right, of energy, right, coming from diverse sources, from Islamic fundamentalism, the Muslim Brotherhood on the one side, and some kind of liberal democratic currents, right, of energy on the other side, right, people have knee-jerk understandings whether what happened in Egypt is basically good, right, and promising, or basically bad and dangerous, right? And I've talked to probably four people in the last 2 weeks, and two, right, were very, very clear, this is a fantastic thing, and the other two were really, really clear, this is a terrible thing, right, with potentially, right, and probable disastrous consequences. So both are simple positions, but both, of course, ignore complexity, right? In order to engage complexity, you need to engage an enormous amount of information. You need to understand, right, in all four quadrants, to use an integral phrase, right, an enormous amount of variables, right, in the upper left, in the interior, right, understanding of the individuals involved, in the lower left, right, in the interior streams and qualities of consciousness within the cultural context, right, in the upper right, right, which is in just the physical facts on the ground, and in the lower right, right, in the governing systems, right, of the collective, right, you know, which exist in the exterior world and how they play with each other, all of that needs to be taken into account, right, at the level of complexity, right, to begin to understand how we might evaluate any particular situation. So beyond simplicity is complexity. But that's not the end of the story. What emerges from complexity is a second simplicity. And we're going to talk about second simplicity in many different ways over the coming weeks. And there are many different ways to unpack this idea. The particular, you know, term emerged, you know, in a sentence I was speaking, right, in mid-sentence with Clint at a teaching session we did some months ago in May in Boulder at one of the iEvolve teaching weekends. But the idea of second simplicity is already, right, in the great traditions very clear. And indeed, we'll bring some of those sources to bear from all of the great traditions that talk using slightly different language in every tradition about the basic goal of spiritual living, right, is to move, to live beyond complexity and to engage the second simplicity. And by second simplicity, what we mean is this ability to constellate, to correlate, right, to integrate, right, to weave together all of the different factors at play and understand not that there's a simple solution. I want to be really clear, right? The second simplicity is different than the first simplicity, right? The first station of simplicity has always a clear course of action available to it. Complexity is kind of looking at all the complex issues that are at play in so many ways. And often complexity paralyzes us. But complexity, right, leads us to a second simplicity. And although the second simplicity might allow for more than one possible course of action, but it has a clarity of understanding, right, about what's at play. But more than a clarity of understanding, it has an internal clarity. It comes from an internal place of calm, an internal sense of being rooted, an internal coherence, right, an internal integration, right, which allows, right, a person who's living at the consciousness of second simplicity, right, to sort through the variables with an elegance, right, with a grace, right, and to be able to deploy, right, into the world, to deploy into action, right, and to access in their own interior face, right, a sense of a depth, right, which is characterized by a kind of, and I'm going to use a term here that Mizumi Roshi, right, who's from a particular Soto Zen line, right, of Zen transmission, Mizumi Roshi called this the free-functioning human being. And the free-functioning human being, right, lives from what we're calling second simplicity, right? They're able to actually step into the flow, right, to have a kind of free-functioning integration, right, a kind of flex flow, right, understanding, right, an intuitive grasp, right, of a kind of big picture, right, and to make the best decision, right, to take the best course of action, to engage in the deepest interior unfolding, right, emergent from the complexity. They're not lost in the complexity. The complexity yields a higher station of consciousness, right, which we're calling second simplicity. And second simplicity, my friends, right, is the goal of spiritual life or of life itself. Right, it's the goal of, right, it's the very impetus. It's that which we're looking towards. And if I can just give you an image, if you can imagine the Randori master, the Tai Chi master, right, who operates, who moves, right, in enormously complex patterns with a deep and profound simplicity. But it's not the simplicity of the one who hasn't engaged the complexity. Right, one who hasn't engaged the complexity, right, to borrow a technical term from the martial arts, doesn't know the kata. The kata is complex, filled, right, with an enormous amount of skilled, precise machinations, movements, right, complex, right, unfoldings. But when all of that complexity, right, is integrated into the person and it emerges at a higher level, at a deeper station of consciousness, what emerges is a second simplicity. Right? And if you will, if we can borrow a term from one of the great visual arts myths of the modern era, right, the Jedi myth, right, which emerged from George Lucas's Skywalker Ranch, right? And that kind of arch myth of 20 years ago, Star Wars, right? The Jedi myth, right? The Jedi Knight, right, lives at this level of second simplicity, right? The spiritual hero, right? The hero of what Kierkegaard would call the hero of spirit, right, lives at this level of second simplicity. So the fundamentalist lives at first simplicity. Often the skeptic, sometimes the agnostic, right, the secularist, right, says all of the knowings that I might have had, right, I can't really hold them because things are too complex. And so the skeptic lives right at this level of complexity and is often unable to discern the strands. Right? It might have an enormous amount of information, but can't quite get to wisdom because wisdom emerges, right, at the level of spiritual consciousness, which we're calling second simplicity. Okay, so that's by way of introduction. Simplicity, complexity, living beyond complexity, second simplicity. Now, what I want to do for the next period of time is at least begin, right? And this is call one. Then there's going to be breakout calls with Zach, Nicole, and Clint week two. And then week three, I'm going to finish and deepen this Dharma sharing, right, together with a question and answer session, just to give you the kind of overview, the overarching meta picture. So I'm just going to begin this now, right, for the next period of time, and then invite, right, if they have Zach and Clint to offer some commentary or weaving, which they may decide to do, or they may decide to do it on next week's breakout call. We'll see. But for now, I'm going to now move the next, right, part three. We did introduction part one. Part two, we set up the meta frame of second simplicity, right, in the first unfolding of one of these holy trinities. And now part three, I want to try and apply it, right, to a particular play in our lives that's unbelievably important. And I want to apply it to what we might call knowing, not knowing, and knowing. And of course, as you can see, this is very directly related to simplicity, complexity, and second simplicity. Knowing, not knowing, and knowing. And let me say it a different way. I'm going to say it a third way. Okay? Story, no story, story. Story, knowing. Let me say it a third way. Clarity, no clarity, confusion, muddled confusion, clarity. Okay? So you begin to see how this plays, and I'm going to unpack this with the grace of God, God in first person, second person, and third person. But just feel it, knowing, not knowing, knowing. Story, no story, story. Clarity, befuddled confusion, and then again, clarity. And let me begin perhaps with confusion. Because confusion has in so many ways, you know, been the kind of core characteristic, right, of so much, right, of the modern period. And in some sense, someone wrote that whoever isn't confused today, right, doesn't know what's going on. Right, there's this sense in modernity that if you're actually in, if you will, right, if you actually understand what's going on, then you must be confused. And if you're not confused, right, there's something fundamentally wrong with you. And so I want to challenge that. But before we challenge it, I want to try and kind of understand where it's coming from. I think it was Simone Weil, right, who said, anyone who isn't confused today simply isn't thinking straight. Now, that's not true. That's a partial truth. And when parts become wholes, we pathologize. But I want to understand with you, where did that partial truth come from? Right? Why could someone as intelligent as Simone Weil, right, suggest anyone who isn't confused today simply isn't thinking straight? And of course, what Simone is suggesting to us is that the second station, right, the station in which there's no story, in which there's, as postmodernism says, there's no grand narrative. There's no storyline. If you remember Kafka's, right? Great work, the trial, right? The core issue in the trial was you couldn't follow the story. You get exhausted trying to follow the story, right? And what Kafka was saying is that we've lost, in any real sense, the thread of the story, and we have, you know, no real way, right, of reclaiming it. So what we want to try and understand is, what's that about, right? Why is it that we would lose the thread of the story, and what might we do, right, to reclaim, right, the thread of the story? I remember, let me see if I can find it for you. Give me one moment. I'm looking in Kafka right now for a quote, which, of course, I should remember by heart, but at my old age, and I just turned 50, right, I don't remember quotes anymore in the same way I used to, which is devastating, and I'll get over it. So give me one second. Because it's an important quote, because it really, you know, Kafka in the trial, you remember the trial? The trial is about someone who's arrested for a particular crime, but he's not quite sure what the crime is. He can never quite figure it out, right? And what Kafka is talking about, and I think his name is K, right? Okay, now I'm remembering, although not finding, right? The plot of the novel is kind of intentionally an impossible thread of story that you can't follow. And so what happens is the thread of meaning frays, right? And at points when, you know, the storyline seems in reach, right, it slips out of grasp again. It's like a lure drawing the reader along, right? So kind of frustration, anger, and a radical hopelessness kind of gradually build in the reader, right, as Kafka subjects us to the very feeling that his protagonist K undergoes as he's arrested for what and by whom he doesn't know. And every time he detects a glimmer of sense in the proceedings, it vanishes into nonsense. So K is overwhelmed, right, incapable of making sense or telling his story, right? He's tortured by a nonsensical system of bureaucracy and human inanity. And here's the passage. It's an all-too-apt passage. Kafka captures how we all feel on occasion about life when we're lost and mired in the complexity, which Simone Weil tells us is the inescapable framework of modernity. You know, Simone Weil suggests that the inescapable framework of modernity is that there is no framework. Okay, and here's the quote from Kafka. He was too tired to survey all the conclusions arising from the story. The simple story had lost its clear outline. He wanted to put it out of his mind. Okay, so Kafka's describing the unique torture of modernity, right, the sense of being disassociated. Right, you can't follow the natural associations in the story. The sense of being what I call de-storied, to be displaced. It's why K has no name, because name is part of a plot, it's part of a story. Like, you know, K has no unique self. He's essentially nameless, devoid of framework, right? Devoid of his story. He has no history. He has no his story. He has no unique self. Right? And through pain, right, the torturer always aims to force the victim to betray or abandon his story. So that's the predicament, right, of complexity, right, in the sense of no story. And what we mean by no story is that we've forgotten the story, right? Let me be really clear here, and let's go really step at a time. In the kind of postmodern understanding, there is no story, right? We've forgotten the story because we should have forgotten it. We've forgotten the story because it deserves to be forgotten, because the old story is a story that wasn't true. The old story was a fundamentalist story, right? The old story was a story in which was dogmatic and based on false premises, based on wrong information, right? It wasn't a wise story. It wasn't an intelligent story. And so that's the core position, right? That's the core position, right, of postmodernism, right? It's very, very deep, right? But the religionist, right, the mystic, right, says something else entirely, right? The mystic says that we've forgotten the story, but that if we would but remember the story, right, it would be a completely different reality. So stay with me. What's the difference between the two? What's the relationship of station one story, Station 1 story, Station 2, no story, no grand narrative, right? And Station 3, a kind of reclaiming of the story. So in Station 1, we're dealing with the story or the knowing, right, of pre-modernity. And pre-modernity believed that it was able to know directly and to have a full picture of the nature of what was. It was able to take a direct and clear snapshot camera picture of reality. It was able to know the story. The weakness of pre-modernity, right, the weaknesses of pre-modernity, its strengths were great and deep and profound. Right, C.S. Lewis, in a wonderful book called The Discarded Image, right, gives the experience and transmits the experience of what does it mean to live in a context of meaning when you know the story. You know the storyline, and if you know the storyline, you know what you're supposed to do in the story. Right? Your life has meaning. Right? It has purpose. It has direction. Right? It has a ground of telos, right, which guides you. You understand what your role is. Right? You understand who the other people in the cast are and what your relationship is. You understand what the goal of your life is. Your life is directional. It's teleological. It's incredibly exciting to live in that context. And that context, right, was the deep abiding context of pre-modernity. The problem was, right, that pre-modernity overreached. It overreached, right? And what happened was the different storytellers, right, of the different traditions, all of which shared some common language, ultimately, though, were unable to distinguish between the parts of their story that actually reflected something real and true about the cosmos and the parts of their story that were just based on their historical context, of their cultural context. They failed to distinguish between what Fritz F. Schumann calls in a great book called The Transcendent Unity of Religions. He posits a distinction between depth structures and surface structures. Right? Surface structures are the cultural, right? The passing, transient beliefs, the dogmas, right, that the different religions held. And the depth structure are the clear, deep, and true understandings, right, that the great traditions held. But because they were unable to make that distinction, right, the great traditions each thought that their vision of reality, including all of their rituals, including a sense of their own superiority, including their right to oppress or attack or disenfranchise or even take the lives of other people who didn't share their vision of reality, right, they believed that that was the nature of things. They believed in the divine right of kings. They believed that because they had true perception about some deep understandings in the depth structures of the cosmos, that also gave them understanding, right, in terms of science. They were able to tell Galileo what he should see through a telescope. They were able to say that Galen's medicine, right, which gave a particular understanding of the physiognomy of the body, was church dogma. And of course, as the world unfolded, we began to realize that this story had overreached. It had overreached its authority. And the authors of the story had claimed authority where they had none. We began to dissect bodies in the Middle Ages, and we realized that Galen's medicine was flat wrong. Cultures began to meet each other, right, and the claims of superiority, right, arrogated by one culture over the other, began to seem inappropriate. Guiding principles that united rather than divided, right, seemed to trump, right, the parochial separations, right, instituted by competing dogmas. And science, right, began to emerge, right, powerfully, right, and to offer a vision of reality, right, which was different, right, than the dogmas of the churches. And so for those reasons and many more that are beyond our time purview now, right, the great story of pre-modernity collapsed. Not that it was completely wrong. It was actually right about a lot. It was right about understandings of meaning. It was right in many of its value insights. It was right in much of its understanding about the true nature of who we are, much of its insight into what it means to be enlightened, much of its insight into ethics and eros. But because it had dramatically overextended its authority, right, into government and into politics and into science, because it had claimed exclusive vision, each one of the strains of pre-modern tradition had claimed an arrogated exclusive authority to itself, for this and other reasons, right, the great story of pre-modernity collapsed. We forgot the story. and we entered into a world of complexity. Right? And in this world of complexity, the assumption was, right, and the assumption grew over a period of 200-300 years, that ultimately there's nothing we can truly know. There is no ultimate knowledge. Ultimate knowledge, by definition, right, isn't available. Right? And that position, right, was expressed by many, many different thinkers, right, in many, many different ways. And the basic assumption was that the only thing that we really know is that which is known through scientific method, which is knowledge of the physical, sensual world, what Hannah Arendt calls the physical, sensual world. And any knowledge, right, that isn't subject to a controlled experiment isn't true knowing, isn't true knowledge. I think Quine, right, the great philosopher Willard Quine, probably the most influential American philosopher, you know, between 1950 and maybe 1980, right? He says something like, let me quote a characterization of Quine's worldview, which is the basic modernist scientific worldview. He says there's fundamentally only one kind of entity in the world, and that there's one kind of study in the world, and that's the kind studied by natural scientists, physical objects. And second, there's only one kind of knowing in the world, and it's the kind that natural scientists have. Essentially, what happened is this scientific outlook, because it was so successful, because it was so effective, it was a kind of effective knowledge that produced incredible leaps in the Industrial Revolution, and then incredible leaps, right, in further unfoldings of technology, and then it leaped again forward, right, 100 years or 80 years ago with quantum mechanics, which produced leaps beyond imagination in medicine and physics and astrophysics and space travel, right? The incredible leaps that were produced by science, right, in essence, in Carl Becker's phrase, ravished the modern mind. And basically, all other forms of knowing were disallowed. So all other grand narratives, right, were thought to be context-bound, right, limited, culturally relative. And the assumption was that there's nothing you could really know because all knowing is based on language and culture, and language and culture are relative. Therefore, there is no genuine knowing other than the knowing of classical science. Right? That was the classical, right, assumption. It's a very, very powerful assumption. The problem, of course, is, you know, and I think it was maybe said best by a sociologist, Manfred Stanley, right? He was at Syracuse University, and he wrote, "It's by now a Sunday supplement commonplace that the modernization of the world is accompanied by a spiritual malaise that has come to be called alienation. At its most fundamental level, the diagnosis of alienation is based on the view that modernization forces upon us a world that, although baptized as real by science, is denuded of all humanly recognizable qualities, beauty, goodness, truth, love, hate, passion, fulfillment, salvation, and damnation. Now, it's not, of course, claimed that such matters are not part of the existential reality of human life. It's rather that the scientific worldview, right, overreaches, just like religion overreached and told a false story. The scientific worldview overreaches and makes a claim that the complexity, right, actually supplants any possibility of a story. Right, the scientific worldview makes it illegitimate to speak of all these essential realities of values, meaning, love, passion, fulfillment, loyalty, beauty, and truth as being in any way objectively part of the world, and forcing us instead to define such evaluation and such internal experience as merely subjective projections of people's inner lives." Okay? That's the great tragedy of a destroyed modernity. That's level two. Level two is we begin to realize incredible complexity. We reject story, right, of station one, right, at station two, at the station of complexity, right? We challenge the story for many, many good reasons. The modern and postmodern critiques of the great traditions, right, incorporate those reasons, but we're left with no story. And so our goal is to go the next step. And with this, I'm going to draw to a close. Our goal is to go the next step and to reclaim story at a higher level of reality, at a higher level of consciousness. When I say a higher level of reality, I'm very careful. Reality as in the word real, right? There's a higher level, a deeper understanding of what's real that expands the realm of the real beyond, as Manfred Stanley said, beyond merely scientific knowing, and actually expands reality to include arenas of the real that are powerful and true and good, right, that tell a story, which is the story of second simplicity. It doesn't undermine complexity. It takes complexity into account, but it transcends complexity, meaning it ends the trance of complexity and allows us to reweave a higher story, a story at station three of consciousness, which allows us to reclaim a sense of a worldview, to reclaim a context of meaning in which we live, to reclaim, right, a big picture, to begin to rethink in terms of great meta-theories, not meta-theories of dogma of the kind that existed at station one, but meta-theories that are constantly evolving, right, constantly evolving meta-theories that begin to make sense out of everything, that move us beyond the nonsense or the dissociation of a lost storyline of complexity. That's where we're going, because in the end, right, it's only, right, when we begin to have a sense of everything that we can get a sense of anything. If you don't have a sense of a history, a his story, right, a storyline of everything, even if it's of the most general kind, which allows you to kind of move with the grace of the master, right, in second simplicity, living beyond complexity, transcending complexity, you're paralyzed. You're unable to form, right, a worldview that's suffused with eros and ethos. And so we're looking for the story beyond the no story. We're looking for the emergent great universe story, which actually envisions a universe, right, a great vision of unfolding complexity, right, which is a second simplicity, right, an evolutionary story which reclaims, right, the broader vision, right, the higher vision. That's where we're going. That's where we're moving towards. Right, and maybe to finish in the last minute and then turn to Zach and Clint with maybe some kind of closing commentary, right, or with a closing story, but just to finish a vision of this. You know, William Sheldon at Columbia University, right, made the correct point, which I think is just desperately in need of being noticed, that when you lose your sense of a worldview, that the loss of worldview, the loss of a big picture, right, is really the loss of an orienting framework. And you don't need to know a lot of psychopathology to know that when you lose a sense of orienting framework, you begin to pathologize. And I would make the suggestion that much of the alienation and the ennui, George Steiner's phrase of our time, right, is the source, right, of much of the pathology of our time, right, of the mental illness of our time, of the breakdown of self of our time, of the fragmentation of our time. It's the loss of story, right? It's the loss, right, of a worldview. And so what we want to do is begin to engage in hope again, hope that emerges from second simplicity, hope that's a memory of the future, of the evolutionary future, that here in the context of this shared study, we're beginning to unpack together. So that's the beginning of a view. And we have 10 minutes left, so let's just breathe for a second. Dharma theory is love. Let me turn to Clint, to Zach, right, to offer any kind of commentary, observation, from whatever context you'd like to come. So, does someone want to start?
Sure, Mark, I'll jump in. This is Clint. And I'll also, since we're, you know, nearing our hour here, I'll say a few things, you know, some reflections on, you know, the beautiful offerings that you've put forth the last little bit here, and then also mention a few things about where we'll go in my breakout next week, and then invite Zach and Nicole, you know, to also do the same. And Zach, you could go next, if you will, and offer whatever other comments you want. Mark, it reminds me, for some reason, the funny story where, you know, we have a teacher friend, great master teacher, who's definitely been around the block, who emailed Mark and I saying, "What were you guys thinking when you named this course Living Beyond Complexity? That has got to be the absolute worst title in the world. And now, while I don't disagree, right, from a marketing perspective, I just can't get over the how that phrase, how that simple injunction, if you will, how deeply it speaks to me, how much of an evolutionary, right, trajectory that it holds and it carries. And for me, it drives us toward, Mark, like what you started to say at the beginning, right, the patterns that connect or a return to a better, more complete sense of the whole. Right? And these are all phrases and concepts that really, if you hear them and you let them sit in your heart, they feel really good. But then if you pull back for a second and you recognize, I don't think my life is like that most of the time. And I'm saying that both about myself, and I suspect it's true for a lot of folks who are on the call with us, that rather our lives are oftentimes mired in complexity. So what then does it mean, right, to live beyond complexity? Or how, like Mark said, how do we end the trance of complexity? And the few points that continue to resound and resonate for me is that, first off, second, simplicity is not easy. Because if it was easy, right, it would fall back, it would slip silently into that first simplicity, which itself is simplistic, right? The second, simplicity is not easy, and second point, it requires us to actually move through complexity. It requires us to be able to end the trance, requires us to transcend and include, to move through it. So, as you all know, like Mark said earlier, one of my big things is helping folks in the world to use integral theory, right, and Ken's AQUIL or all quadrant, all level framework to discover ways to move beyond complexity. But we all have to admit to ourselves that oftentimes it feels like we're just mired in complexity, because AQUIL is really dense and it's really confusing, and it's, you know, we don't have that much time to become, you know, radical scholars in it. So the focus of my breakout and the focus of most of what I hope I can offer as a gift throughout this entire course will be sort of learning from the trenches, if you will, in doing that work of utilizing the integral framework, right, the integral map, to actually, and you guys have all heard this statement before, right, to use that map to help you understand and navigate the complex territory of your life. But again, what does that mean? Like, do we actually do that? Do we have the skills and capacities? And I think the answer, generally speaking, is no, not really, because this is still evolving. And we're evolving and we're moving, and that's what's so beautiful about doing this work with Mark, with Zach, with Nicole, with all of you. We're moving toward this second simplicity. So what I'd like to offer is some principles, some concepts, some practices that will help us do just that, help us use this map to actually understand and navigate the complex territory of our lives. So next week, we'll focus on this sort of whole issue by looking through, if we can, what Mark and I came to call in one conversation we had a while back, the grandmother issue. And it's how do we understand the growth and development and so-called enlightenment, right, of our deeply realized grandmother, who just happens to be living in a radically traditional culture. And what many of you probably intuit already is that at a minimum, we need to look towards structure stages, like Mark mentioned before, and towards state stages. So through the lens of sort of looking at this grandmother koan, if you will, we'll go into structure stages, state stages next week, and further flesh out practices and capacities for recognizing where we are, where you are as individuals on this path of evolution and development from simplicity to complexity to second simplicity.
Wonderful. Thank you, Clint. Zach.
Yes. Hey, everybody. It's just beautiful to be on the call and to hear Mark and Clint, and it's exciting. It's this kind of stuff gives me energy. So I was telling my wife, it's like going to a church group or something. You put in a long day of work, and then it's like, you know, you're in the basement of the Unitarian Church, and you're all kind of vibing, and of course it's all techno and digital these days. But so I'll just say a couple things and then touch base about kind of what I want to do in my sessions. I mean, the first thing is basically I see this problem of finding the second simplicity as the, one of the great problems of our historical epoch, kind of both on the macro and the micro. So kind of on the macro, we are totally incoherent. I sometimes say that we were facing a species-wide identity crisis, which is to say that for the first time that we are globally interconnected through communications, media, and transnational commerce, et cetera, the kind of infrastructure of global capitalism that unites us. So we're all speaking through the same channels, but we're more confused about the meaning of our humanity than we've ever been. And so the task of weaving a kind of social meta-narrative that could unite humanity, I think, is a task. And then on the micro level, when you're talking about individual socialization processes, it's never been harder to weave, at least in the post-industrial West, it's never been harder to weave a coherent narrative about your own life. You know, one cause for the rapid rise in divorce rates in post-war America is because of this age of fracture, right? This age of increasing fragmentation socioculturally. I'm a philosopher, but I'm also an educationist. So this is, for me, an educational problem about how do we weave a coherent, action-orienting self-understanding when we are inundated by information like never before. So I just kind of want to put that context out there and say this is an important problem for the species now. But I would also say it's a particularly important problem for us integral folk, if I can kind of use that label there. Because as Clint said, you know, this integral meta-theory, which for many of us kind of lifted us to the second simplicity, or at least allowed us to glimpse it, when you start talking this stuff to everyday people, they just think you're mired in complexity, and maybe you are, right? So one of the things I do is work with educational reformers who've never heard of Wilbur, and one of the things I have to do is find ways to use this complicated meta-theory in simple ways, using simple language that people on Main Street can understand. So one of the things I want to do in my sessions is, and I like Clint's term, radical scholarship. I want to get down to the historical roots of some of Wilbur's main ideas and actually run these stations on some of Wilbur's key terminology. So that basically means, like, you first read Wilbur, you get it, you love it, it's so simple, this is it, you tell everybody about it. But then, of course, you need to move to the second stage, which is that, oh, my God, this Wilbur guy is full of crap. He's borrowing this stuff from people and yada, yada. And, you know, actually, development's not that simple. And actually, there's competing views on the, you know, neural substrates for emotion and yada, yada. So there's all this complexity where some people then you dismiss him. And then my point is that, well, that is actually a second simplicity. There's a way to reengage with these kinds of meta-theorists, put them on the table, and then find a new language, a simpler language that allows you to articulate it both to others and allows you to integrate it into your action-orienting self-understanding in a way that's actually tractable and doesn't leave you mired in confusion. So that's kind of where I want to go. I actually want to give you texts, right, some of the primary sources that Wilbur worked from, some of the contemporaneous sources that are actually simpler ways of saying the same thing that we'd all like to say. That's kind of where I'm going, much more the academic footnotes and kind of getting in touch with the broader cultural zeitgeist, trying to move beyond this kind of integral parochialism that I think sometimes we end up shooting ourselves in the foot in the real world. So that's my two cents there.
Thank you, Zach. Thank you, Zach. Nick, do you want to weigh in?
Yeah, hello, everyone. Yeah, first I just want to echo Zach and just huge props to the just passion and sizzle that I'm feeling already in an hour's time listening to this call. And it's just been, like, so enlivening and exciting to me. And I also just want to thank everybody that's listening in for being with us tonight and on the journey. going forward. I'm also just really honored and humbled to be working kind of amongst these three veritable geniuses. And my unique gift really and contribution to you in this course structure as a certified integral life coach is to really bring what we're learning about in these calls right off the call and right onto the sort of playing field of your life, as it were. So how do these enlightening words and concepts show up, you know, or how do I find the second simplicity in my life in the moments that really matter? Because as we've heard throughout this call, second simplicity is not just a learned thing, really, it's a lived thing. So how do I access and exercise this knowing and being just such that I continue to grow into a kinder and more loving and compassionate and maybe even happier with the life that I'm leading? So that's kind of where practice comes into play, and that's what my breakout is going to be all about. And I just want to take a step back, and for those of you who may not know the definition of practice, kind of as we're using it in this context, it's just really anything that you're regularly engaging in your life in order to grow as a human being and to increase your health and well-being. And then if you take it one step deeper, it's really not merely for your own personal benefit, though it certainly can fulfill personal aims. Rather, it just really starts there and then kind of extends outward to your friends, your family, to your colleagues that you interact with every day. And then beyond that, even into service of all beings. So kind of with that deepest of motivations and potentialities, and I would call it a responsibility for practice, I want to invite you to join me on my breakout calls to just really deepen your full-bodied understanding and just the daily engagement with the beautiful Dharma that we began to hear tonight. So next week, we'll take more of a meta view of your practice in your life to kick things off. Just to see what's happening with it now and really how targeted is it to working on what's really most pressing in your life, kind of getting the larger container of your practice on a track that's more in alignment with those specific needs and goals.
Beautiful.
And really that's thereby kind of finding sort of the second simplicity and even just like an exhale of the precision that holds and honors the complexity of your whole being. So I want to invite you to come on, and we'll have some fun. We'll play with practices on the calls, and I'll give you practices to engage in between calls. There'll also be time for Q&A on my calls and around your specific questions and challenges. And all you really need is your full self and journal and pen, and I hope you'll join me. And that's really it. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you, Nick. Thank you, Nicole. So beautiful. Thank you, Clint, and thank you, Zach, and thank you, Nicole. And we're going to finish now, everyone, because we're about 4 minutes over time. So let me just finish with an image and invite you to these fantastic breakout sessions next week. And then the third week, we'll come back together in a call that's somewhat like today, but with a section for Q&A and some more weaving. So let's just try and kind of finish understanding where we are. You know, there's a beautiful old text in the sacred traditions which talks about the divine, right, the deep meta meshwork of meaning of all that is, the love intelligence of all that is, right, the understanding of the broader vision and story, right, that the divine is hidden. And the text reads, Vanochi haster astir panai, right, I will hide my face. And the word I will hide, is repeated twice. And so the mystical masters, my lineage teachers, right, read it by saying, right, the hiddenness is hidden. Taking a step deeper, if we forget the story, we can always remember it. Right? The great tragedy of post-modernity is not only have we forgotten the story, but we've forgotten that we've forgotten. When we've forgotten that we've forgotten, we don't even remember, right, what it might mean to live, right, in a context of meaning, right, to live, right, in the greater story. And as Nick, as Nicole said, you know, very beautifully and very correctly, right, we're engaging in this process in order to deepen our personal lives, in order to become more whole, more healthy. We're engaging in order to be better lovers, better parents, better friends, better colleagues, better human beings. But we're also engaging it, right, as an evolutionary act for the sake of the all. We're engaging in this evolution of consciousness because every generation is responsible for its evolution of consciousness. And the inner fabric of consciousness, Sat Chit Ananda, Sat, consciousness, right, Sat being, right, Chit really is consciousness, right, Ananda is love. So the inner understanding, the inner fabric of consciousness, right, of Chit is Ananda is love. So the evolution of consciousness is, right, the evolution of love. Right, which we're engaged in for the sake of all being, right? Because we can, because we have, thank God, the minds, the hearts, the ability to engage in this, we're actually entering into the leading edge and humbly, audaciously, radically, right, seeking to evolve consciousness for our own sakes and for the sake of all future generations, for the sake of all sentient beings, because that is the core act of a bodhisattva. We all need to be bodhisattvas, emerging from a cosmocentric consciousness to take responsibility for the being and becoming for the next unfolding. So thank you, everyone. A deep bow of virtue into virtual reality. And we'll try and be more precise in terms of finishing on time next week. Thank you to everyone. Have fantastic breakout calls next week. Clint, is there any more logistics we need to close, or can we close here?
No, let's close here, and I'll just say that y'all be getting an email tomorrow that'll explain a few more logistical points about downloads and scheduling and whatnot. So just look forward to that, and thanks, everybody, for joining us.
Deep out, everyone. Beautiful day, beautiful evening. Thank you.